right, welcome back. This is George Whitehurst Berry. Welcome to our new program, Crash, Are You Ready? Today, we're scheduled to have a very special guest, Eustace Mullins, world-renowned authority on the Federal Reserve Bank and author of numerous books, such as The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, and also books on the health issues, such as The Murder by Injection, about the dangers of vaccines. I was listening to the news before the program began and heard the discussion about the suspension of habeas corpus in the United States. Let me say this. If you have a suspension of habeas corpus, you're not moving towards a police state. You're already in a police state. So it's academic to talk about losing freedoms when, in fact, you've already lost them. What we're going to talk about today, as soon as we get Eustace on the line, is that the history of this country is basically a history of the forces of freedom battling the international bankers and their debt money system right from the very beginning of our country's existence, from the Revolutionary War right up until the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, when they finally got the debt money system installed as a national, quote-unquote national, which is really a private banking system. We have also Eustace Mullins is one of the only surviving people that actually knew the poet Ezra Pound. Now, Ezra Pound was a contemporary of Ernest Hemingway, and Pound greatly influenced. Many people said he was the number one influence on the literature of his time. He was very interested in the money system, and he began to research the money system, and he understood and discovered the differences between a parasitic debt money system and an organic debt-free money system. He was a strong advocate of a local economy, and indeed, in the Depression, what we see is, that was debt bubble number one. This is debt bubble number two today. What we see in the Depression, any listeners out there know how the local economies survived during the Depression? Have you ever researched it? Has your stockbroker or CPA or financial planner ever told you about it, or is he or she even aware of it? 99% of them, I believe, have no concept of how the communities survived during the Depression. Of course, the Depression was engineered. They planned it that way, contrary to what you hear and read in the mass media. The money masters know very well what they're doing when they create the parameters necessary for a depression. These people are not stupid at all. They know exactly what they're doing. And we have that sequence of events, in my opinion, in debt bubble number two, with the fundamental numbers even worse than they were during the Great Depression. But how the local communities survived is that they issued their own local currencies. And there were dozens, literally dozens, of different kinds of depression script. It wasn't gold or silver that came to the rescue, contrary to what you've been told. In 1933, and prior to 1933, there were all kinds of gold and silver media of exchange. We had gold certificates prior to 1933 in circulation. We had silver certificates. We had silver coinage. We had gold coin. None of it, contrary, if you listen to what most of the hard asset advocates are saying today, there is a place for gold I believe, in everybody's portfolio in the proper, what I believe is the proper form. In fact, I believe that the proper type of gold coin is going to be essential to survive the coming economic collapse. So keep that in mind. However, there are certain things that gold will do and certain things it will not do. It did not, with all the gold coinage in circulation, with all the gold certificates, silver coinage in circulation, it did not prevent the Great Depression. Because it is the money masters that are pulling the strings, it is the money masters that are controlling the money system. And no amount of gold in circulation prevented that crash. Keep that in mind. It's very, most of the people today in the hard asset business are telling you that if we only had something, quote unquote, backing up the money system, that all of our economic problems would be solved. And what I'm saying is none of the Great Depression was ever prevented by having gold coins in circulation or silver coinage or gold certificates or silver certificates. And in fact, I can prove mathematically to you that the international bankers can literally bankrupt you on a gold standard. And I can prove that mathematically. That's what they don't want you to know. So the way that the local economy survived in the Great Depression, remember, one of the earmarks of a depression is a critical shortage of circulating medium. They issued their own depression script. This was exactly like what the colonies did. Remember, obviously in colonial times they had their own colonial currency, and they issued their own debt-free, interest-free currency into circulation. Now, when a couple of British representatives took a tour of Philadelphia with Benjamin Franklin, they were astonished at the level of prosperity that they saw. And they asked Ben Franklin, how do you do this? You know, I mean, this is fantastic, but you know, Ben, we want to see all of Philadelphia while we're here. We don't want to just see the good side of town. We want to see the poor houses. And Benjamin Franklin looked them straight in the eye and said, "Sirs, in the colonies, we do not have any poor houses. And even if we had poor houses, we wouldn't have anybody to put in them." And they said, "How do you do that?" He said, "We issue our own debt-free, interest-free currency into circulation, and we issue it in proportion to the needs of commerce." Back after the break. All right, we're back after the break. This is George Whitehurst Berry. Welcome to our new show, Crash, Are You Ready? We now have world-renowned authority on the Federal Reserve Bank and the parasitic debt money system on the line, Eustace Mullins. Eustace, are you there?
Oh, yes. I had a little trouble getting the call through. I don't know what tomorrow
is. All right.
Was.
Well, we got through, and we have, I believe, the worst fiscal crisis right now that this country has ever faced. In my opinion, it's probably the fundamental numbers are probably worse than the Great Depression. How severe do you believe that the coming economic collapse is going to be, and how the heck did we get into this mess?
Well, we got into it through banker manipulation, just like we get into everything. Now, Greenspan said on television on Sunday night that we are going into a recession.
Mm-hmm.
So he probably would know that.
Yeah, that's a nice statement there.
Yes. And he didn't offer any corrective means to win to guard off the recession, but
uh-huh.
He just said state that in fact.
Well, he certainly ought to know. I mean, it was the international bankers that set the stage for the collapse. I mean, these people are not stupid. They know exactly what they're doing. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the economic history of the debt money system, which has been literally edited out of our college textbooks? I mean, this is never taught today to the financial planners, CEOs, brokers that are giving people retirement advice. How do how do we get into this?
Well, we got into it as a war measure. You see, the Federal Reserve was passed as a wartime measure. Yeah, the Federal Reserve is a central bank, and the primary function of a central bank is to, war finance. So they set up World War One with Woodrow. They set up World War One by electing President Woodrow Wilson to sign the Federal Reserve Act into law, and so then we went right into World War One by lending Great Britain $400 million, which Great Britain used to get into the war.
Well, isn't that eerily similar to the tactics they're using today? There's a perpetual emergency. There's always some kind of a war, so you need to surrender your constitutional rights because there's a perpetual emergency. So they got us into this Federal Reserve system through the pretext of a national emergency.
Oh, yes.
Obviously that was not the first attempt that the international bankers had made to put us into a parasitic debt money system. Can you tell our listeners about some of the earlier history of our country going back to the Revolutionary War? Did not Benjamin Franklin say something to the effect, we would gladly have borne a tax on tea, that's not why we went to war. We went to war because the Bank of England was trying to install its debt money system into the colonies.
Oh, yes, the Bank of England ran the whole show. And Franklin was perfectly correct. He understood money, and he saw that the Bank of England was simply trying to protect its debt money system.
Well,
and that's been the history of the United States ever since, because after the Revolution, the bankers moved in, they've run everything since.
Is any of this being taught in our colleges today?
Oh, absolutely nothing. Not only not being taught in the colleges, but the business people have no concept of this whatsoever. You know, I've given copies of my Federal Reserve book to bankers for years in this area, and they get absolutely no comprehension whatsoever. It's totally foreign to them.
Well, and you laid a lot of this out in your book, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, many years ago.
Oh, yeah, that's a textbook of the whole operation.
I remember, in fact, after the colonists won the Revolutionary War, won their independence, we had a battle going on between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, and Jefferson said, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their money, first by inflation, that's like the Roaring Twenties, then by deflation, that's like the Depression that followed, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of their property until their children will wake up homeless in the continent their fathers conquered. Now, this man, this economist, by the name of Thomas Jefferson, is never quoted in the economics textbooks today. He was battling Alexander Hamilton. Was Alexander Hamilton a Rothschild agent?
All his life.
I'm sorry?
He never was anything but a Rothschild agent.
He was never anything but a Rothschild agent.
He set up the first bank of the United States, which, of course, was a central bank.
And now,
Jefferson fought that.
And Jefferson fought it, and in the college textbooks today for the CPAs, stockbrokers, financial planners, we never see anything but praise for the national bank. I remember hearing in one of your tapes that you mentioned that the sole reason for the War of 1812 was that when Thomas Jefferson was president and the charter for the national bank, a renewal of the charter of the National Bank came up. Thomas Jefferson refused to renew the charter of the National Bank, and you said that was the sole purpose for the War of 1812, and it's never taught in any college textbook today.
It's never mentioned in any history book of any kind.
How many financial advisors realize that today? Well, in the ensuing decades, they kept fighting, and then they finally got the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. Jacob Schiff and Paul Warburg, could you tell our listeners a little bit about how they accomplished this nasty little sequence of events?
Fortune magazine in 1932, the February issue of 1932, gave a great deal of comment to the fact that the Rothschilds had never had any part in American finance. And this is a secret that they kept for many years, because by claiming to have nothing to do in America, they wouldn't do anything financial in this country. They were actually running the whole show through two subsidiary firms, J.P. Morgan Company and Kuhn-Loeb Company.
Oh, boy.
And they controlled all the finance of this country.
All right, we'll be back after the break with Eustace Mullins. All right, we're back after the break with Eustace Mullins. This is George Whitehurst Berry. Welcome back to our new program, Crash, Are You Ready? Eustace Mullins is one of the few remaining people who actually knew and worked with Ezra Pound, the poet Ezra Pound. Ezra Pound made quite a lot of discoveries about the money system, and he was a very firm believer in getting the economy to the local level instead of allowing the international bankers to run the entire economy from the central, quote unquote, central bank. And also Ezra Pound was a very firm believer in the ideas of Douglas and another gentleman by the name of Silvio Gesell. Now, going back to how did these communities survive the Depression, they issued their own Depression script. And I remember years ago seeing a local currency from Mason City, Iowa. And it was fascinating because they were using the ideas of Silvio Gesell, whom Ezra Pound was very fond of. And on the back of this currency, this local currency, there was a stamp. Now, if you didn't spend the money, the idea was to get this money to circulate during the Depression when there was a shortage of circulating medium. If you did not spend this currency within a certain length of time, you had to affix another stamp and pay for another stamp. Now, when I looked at this currency, every single stamp on the back, every single space for a stamp on this currency, which was after Silvio Gesell's ideas, whom Ezra Pound greatly admired, every single stamp was affixed to the back of that currency, which tells me that this currency worked. It circulated as money, and it worked extremely well. Now, Eustace, can you tell us about Ezra Pound's views on the money system?
His views on the monetary system caused him to be indicted by no less than Alger Hiss on a charge of treason, and he was arrested when we went to Italy in 1944 and flown back to Washington, and they was told he would be charged with treason, which is a capital offense. Well, the only problem was they had no evidence of any kind whatsoever. Treason consists of giving aid and comfort to the enemy in wartime, and Ezra gave no aid whatsoever to the comfort of Italy during World War II. So they never could try him, and in fact they called him in and they said, how will you defend yourself in this trial? And Ezra said, I will stand by everything I ever said over Radio Rome. And they were absolutely floored by that, because the last thing they wanted to do was repeat in court what he had said over at Radio Rome during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So they got three psychiatrists, government psychiatrists, to come in and declare him incompetent to participate in his own defense, because his defense was that he would stand by everything he ever said.
And, I remember that Ezra Pound said that if I did not tell the truth about the money system, I would be guilty in the common law of misprison of a felony.
Yeah, he often said that. And that's exactly true. He was doing his duty as a citizen by announcing his knowledge of misprison of a felony.
So I'm not guilty of treason for telling the truth, but I would be guilty of misprison of a felony if I did not expose what the Roosevelt administration and the international bankers were up to. I remember growing up as a Cold War baby, they would always talk about how these political dissidents were declared insane. In other words, they were not insane. They were political dissidents. But a favorite tactic of the communist government was to declare people that were political dissidents to be insane. So this would confuse Joe Sixpack, the common individual, into thinking that they were in fact crazy. You knew Ezra Pound personally. Was he ever crazy, or was he put in the insane asylum because he knew too much?
He knew too much. It was a constant tactic of Joseph Stalin himself.
Uh-huh.
He put his political opponents in the insane asylum. And then everybody would say, well, they're crazy, so we won't believe anything they say. And that was the tactic they used to put Ezra Pound in the insane asylum. But people that went there, including myself, found immediately that he was not insane at all. So it's sort of, he had 3,800 visitors during the 15 years he was in prison there.
Okay, listeners, here you have a first-hand account that we, under the Roosevelt administration in this country, were doing the same things that the communists were doing during the Cold War. So if you think that we have not had political prisoners in this country, think again.
Well, Ezra Pound told me that everybody who was in St. Elizabeth was there because somebody wanted them there.
Uh-huh.
And that's really the story.
Now, Ezra Pound was probably the most influential literary figure of his generation, and I believe just about every one of the great writers acknowledges a debt to Ezra Pound. What are your personal recognitions of what are your personal reminiscences of Ezra Pound the person?
Well, he was always a leader, he was always a patriot, and he was a political prisoner. Because the charges against him were so flimsy that they never dared try him. So they kept him in an insane asylum for 15 years, and I introduced him to a North Dakota congressman who went on the floor of the House and said, "Why is the government holding this man?" And the government could make no answer, because they had no evidence of any kind against him. So they immediately released him. That's how Ezra got out after people were boasting in Washington that Ezra Pound would never leave St. Elizabeth alive. And they were boasting that when I met him. And then suddenly he dropped all charges and he walked out.
Well, was it that Roosevelt, they got too embarrassed? I mean, were too many people...
Oh, they were very embarrassed, because all over the world, people were saying, why are you keeping Ezra Pound in prison? Because this is the most famous writer in the world. Four of his proteges were awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. And Ernest
uh-huh.
Hemingway, who is not a very good writer, but Ezra was able to help him get a couple of books out.
And yet many more people today know about Ernest Hemingway than they do about Ezra Pound, who was the greatest figure, literary figure of his era.
Oh, yes. They're still pumping up Hemingway's reputation by teaching him in all the colleges. Do you know, Ernest Hemingway still sells 5 million books a year, and that's purely through Ezra's influence.
Well, I can walk into any Borders or Barnes & Noble today, and I'll see Ezra Pound on the shelf.
Back after
the break with Eustace Mullins. This is George Poythorus Berry. We're back after the break with our very special guest, Eustace Mullins. We're going to open up this last segment to call-ins. The number for your questions for Eustace or comments is 1-800-259-9231, 1-800-259-9231. You have a rare opportunity here to ask questions of one of the greatest living authorities on the Federal Reserve Bank and the parasitic debt money system, and also of the great poet Ezra Pound. 1-800-259-9231 for your questions or comments. Eustace, I hear a lot of talk about what do we do? I mean, we're in this terrible mess. What do we do? How do we get out of it? And of course, most people, I would say probably 99% of the people in the patriotic community are woefully ignorant of the mechanics of the money system. I know that Ezra Pound was a great advocate of the, he said you have to get the economy on the local, you have to have a strong economy on the local level. And there's a perfect example of how a local economy can be strong on the local level, and that is Ithaca, New York, and they have their own local currency. They've been doing it's not something new. It isn't as if will this work, will it not work. They've been doing this for years, and they're called Ithaca Hours. Is this the type of thing that Ezra Pound envisioned?
Ezra Pound's favorite subject was local control of local purchasing power. When they moved the purchasing power and monetary system of the United States to Wall Street, they no longer had any local control of purchasing power, and the local people had nothing to say about it. And that's the situation we're in. In World War One, we were actually occupied by foreign power. And we were under enemy occupation all during World War One, and the proof of that is that a triumvirate ruled the United States during World War One, and that was President Woodrow Wilson, whom that Wall Street had picked for the presidency, and his intimate counsel was Colonel Edward House, a Rothschild agent, and so. And then they brought over from London Sir William Wiseman, the head of the British Secret Service. And Sir William Wiseman and Colonel House ran everything in this country during World War One. So we were under enemy occupation. And every military decision, every economic decision, and Paul Warburg was the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve System. And his brother, Max Warburg, was the chief intelligence advisor to Kaiser Wilhelm I, with whom we were at war. So several congressmen brought this up during World War I. Is there any conflict of interest between Max Orberg being the intelligence advisor to the Kaiser. He was also his financial advisor. They said, is there any conflict? He's doing this during wartime, isn't he? He's an enemy agent. And so immediate an outcry arose in Washington, but this was a terrible thing to say about anybody, and that Paul Warburg certainly was not an enemy agent. So they, but there was quite a bit of comment over this for 2 weeks in the Congress of the United States, and they finally concluded Max Warburg and Paul Warburg were not enemy agents.
And
Colonel House kept running the whole show.
They were not enemy agents, I remember years ago that they got all the mass media got all over Billy Carter because he was doing some promotional activities for Libya, I believe, if I remember correctly, and they got all over him as for being an unregistered foreign agent. They wanted him to register, so you have people working for the money masters, and they don't have to register as foreign agents working for a foreign power.
Oh, they never register. This country has been run by unregistered foreign agents. Look at the state of Israel. Israel has 600 people in Washington today are all unregistered enemy agents. And they're the most powerful people in Washington.
We're in this mess. I believe that we're in the beginning stages of probably the biggest financial collapse in the history of this country. Have we already lost the battle? Is it too late to do anything to rectify the situation? Or, in other words, at this point, it seems that, 95% of the American public is so dumbed down as far as I can see, this coming collapse is inevitable. What is your opinion on, have we already lost our economic freedom, or is there anything we can do at this point?
We've lost our economic freedom, but we've always lost that anyway. We never had it, so that's no problem. I have lectured all over this country in the last 50 years, and I've told everywhere that America is just beginning to fulfill its promise. We're still the greatest nation in the world, and our future is ahead of us, because we haven't even started to be a real country yet. And the American people are completely untouched by all this mass propaganda. It doesn't even get through to them. And because they control the television and newspapers, and we get the State of Israel propaganda 24 hours a day, but people just don't pay attention to it anymore. And so I think the country is in great shape.
Well, as far as I can see, we're in the terminal stages of the world's most gigantic Ponzi or pyramid scheme.
Oh, yeah. And, well, it is a pyramid scheme. That's all it ever has been. That's what you have with fake money, occupation money.
How severe do you think that the real estate crash is going to be?
We're all experiencing it at first time. It's not too serious at all. Because a rollback in the real estate prices, but that was overextended. It's really what you'd call in the stock market a correction. You're getting a real estate correction because too many people are buying $5 million houses that were actually worth $50,000. And when you have that greater disparity, it's going to show up somewhere. And now it's showing up everywhere.
Okay. I believe these people knew what they were doing in the final stages of the orgy of buying. They took off all restrictions, and they made loans to people who should never have gotten loans, and the sheer magnitude of this subprime crisis is $1.8 trillion. I believe that's enough to potentially collapse the entire economy. What is your opinion on that?
It could potentially collapse the economy if everybody was called in on all the loans, but the fact is they won't do that because that would be counterproductive. As long as they keep the pyramid scheme going and getting the money from it, they'll keep it going.
Well, yeah, but a Ponzi scheme has a finite lifespan. Mechanically, a Ponzi scheme must collapse because they cannot run a pyramid scheme forever. It's mathematically impossible.
Well, that's absolutely true. I predicted when I wrote my Federal Reserve book in 1953 that the Federal Reserve scam was intended to last only 25 years because they figured they couldn't get away with it longer than 25 years. And they've been keeping it going ever since.
The first debt bubble culminated with the Great Depression. I believe this debt bubble is going to make the Great Depression look like child's play. Thank you, Eustace, and it's a pleasure to have you. We'll be back again Monday. Welcome back, Monday.